Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's June 6, 2014. You're listening to the best poker podcast there is. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
So, it's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's so wonderful that neither one of us are going to be out there this year.
You know, I love
that.
That's
how wonderful it is.
I can't tell you how many of our listeners and our writers like text me and they're like, "Hey, when am I going to see you in Vegas this year?" And I'm like, "Hey, never." And I just love saying it. I don't have to go this year. It's so much fun. And you're not going, so we're both not going this year.
No, unless some kind of a cataclysmic thing comes up here and I decide to go last minute, I'm going to be home. And it's kind of weird, too, because people are like, I can't believe you're not going to be in Vegas. One or two of you are not going to be in Vegas. And I guess on the outside it is kind of weird, but, you know, we've gone every year. Sometimes I've gone two or three times.
Yeah.
And there used to be a real business reason for us to be out there, and now there just isn't anymore other than just being there.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have no problem just being there because it's amazing to be out there during the World Series. It really is. But as much traveling as I've done recently, I'm going to look forward to this like little 5-week window I have where I can actually hang out at home and let my wife remember what I look like.
Yeah, and you know what else too? It's not that Annie Up's not there. It's just that you and I.
Very true.
There.
Very.
I mean, we have a ton of writers that are there enjoying it and getting information about their players, and then we also have salespeople that are that live there or live close to there who are going to be there. So we're represented. We got a nice rack out there with a bunch of magazines, and it's just me and you. We're finally taking a break from it. That's all.
But we are monitoring it from all the way here in Florida.
That's right. We are following the progress.
And 11 events are in the books already out of like, I don't know, 60 or something like this year, right?
Yeah.
So only a sixth of the way through this thing, and already a lot of great stories. So first one, kind of somewhat in order as we go through of what I thought was interesting so far. Vanessa Selps wins her third bracelet. That ties her with Barbara Enright for the most by a woman, and that came in event two, which was a 25K buy-in mix max. I love the fact that it was a 25K.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a huge event, a ton of money, and yeah, she's a real deal, man. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, and what I like, it's funny because I was just finished the last mini season of Mad Men, which I know you probably don't watch, right?
No.
But I was reading a couple of reviews, and at one point there's a comment where there's a female ad exec. Of course, it's set in the 60s, right? So
yeah.
Sexism and stuff, right? And one of the lines was, she's the best woman in advertising. And in the review, people were kind of taking issue with that. I mean, obviously, they know it was part of the show, right? But
yeah.
It just shows the times, right? That yeah. They couldn't just say the best best person in advertising, had to say woman. And I've seen some of this with people after Vanessa won this. I've seen, and I don't think anybody meant anything by it, but it's one of the things I notice now is, boy, she's the best woman player out there right now. You know what, folks? She's one of the best players out there right now.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just World Series success either. It was NAPT. She destroyed that. She does well on the World Poker Tour. She does well on the EPT. I mean, she just plays everywhere. She's just a great poker player, and that's all. You don't even have to say that she's a female poker player or anything like that. She's just fantastic. And I'm real happy for her. I know she gets a lot of guff for how harsh she is on certain topics and stuff, but she's a great person and fantastic player.
Super player. And this next one, I think, I'm glad I updated the file this morning and saw this, because this is what I really love about the World Series. First of all, Tuan Lee gets his first bracelet, finally, one of the great players out there. He beat Justin Bonomo heads up in the 10K buy-in, deuce to seven triple draw in event number five. And then Bonomo comes back to win event 11, which is a $1,500 buy-in, six-handed. So, you know, these players that really have the World Series figured out, and I think Justin Bonomo is clearly one of those. you know, it's going to be disappointing to get all that way, finish second.
Yeah.
But then you've got another event right the next day, right? Or the day after that, and you can win that one, and that's exactly what he went out and did. It's pretty amazing.
Can you say player of the year?
At this early stage, absolutely.
Yeah, he's already got two finals, a runner-up, and a win. That's crazy.
First 11 events, yeah, absolutely. And he might have a couple of caches. I don't know. I didn't dig that deep, but it's possible that he's done well somewhere else, too.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, I think anybody would take a heads-up at a heads-up in a title for the entire 60 events.
Yeah, absolutely. He's already assured of a great World Series, and he's got the rest of the month to do it and a little more into the next month. So,
yeah, what kind of frame of mind does that put you in, do you think, you know? Because, I mean, you look at some of these players that go out there, and they're really great players, and they just struggle for whatever reason. They just not get the cards, or things happen early on. And I think that's just got to build up, doesn't it? Like, you know, when you get so close, or you're just not there, and it's stressful. I mean, I don't know Justin any more than the one time that we've had him on the show, but I got to think, whoever you are, this has put you in a great frame of mind to have a great series at this point, right?
I mean, absolutely.
You got your entire trip paid for already.
Yep. It's just like anything else. You know, you win that first rack when you're playing pool, or you throw a 300 the first game bowling, or, you know, baseball, you hit a home run the first time up, whatever it is, and then the rest of the day you're just cruising. You're like, yes, you know, this is great. I've got a great day ahead of me already now. And then you're just you're totally relaxed. And, you know, in a lot of the cases, too, people got backers and stuff, which we'll get to something like that about
sure.
that a little bit later on. But, you know, now the backer is happy. You've paid for your whole trip or whatever. And a lot of pressure's off. And once you have no pressure, you totally always succeed and perform at your highest performance, you know, peak performance that you can. So that... it's going to be good. And, you know, let's not take away from Tuan Lee. He actually won his first bracelet.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the photo of him winning it, too, he's sort of looking up at the bracelet, like inspecting it. Like, is it real? Did I really win this? So congratulations to him as well and both those guys. And I think that's what – is that Bonham a second, I think? Or
At least a second.
Yeah, at least a second. I just don't remember if it was his third or not. But good for him.
Yeah, and so I'm kind of curious. I don't know if anybody's ever done a study on this, but I'd be interested to see – and I'm talking about well-known players. I'm talking about amateurs, but well-known players that struggle early, whether they play more events than players that do well early. Because I think the other thing too is, I mean, it's kind of a weird situation to be in, right? If you've just won an event, you got a second event, everything's paid for. I would think part of the taking the pressure off is, you know what? You know, I'm going to skip an event. You know, I'm just going to relax now because I don't feel like I have to play it to put food on my table, right?
Right.
And maybe other people would say, no, hey, I've got all this money now. I'm going to try everything. Whereas I think the opposite thing, if you're struggling early on, I think there's the pressure, hey, I wasn't going to play these events, but I got to make something happen.
Yeah.
And that just makes you play worse, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Something that we should pay like a bunch of you know, researchers to look up and scientists to test. Because really, though, I mean – when you're playing and you know you've secured money, like in a tournament, you know, you're past the bubble, and then you play differently. You're kind of like, all right, now I don't have to worry about it. Now I can relax and not, you know. So now that you've won a bunch of money and you can play all these tournaments and not hurt your bottom line, why not keep trying and just free rolling into it? It's a free roll, you know. But at the same time, you're like, ah, I made all my money. I can enjoy the summer. I don't need to play that, you know, remote 1K millionaire maker with a bunch of dweebs. You know, I could just relax. But that's a good point. I wonder, you know, the frame of mind's got to be different for each person. But for me, I knew if I had won a bracelet and had a ton of money and my summer was set, I would play as many events as I could because I'm thinking, you know, I can't lose. So why not go out and try to win another one and be player of the year? Because you can cash in on there's a lot of fringe benefits to being player
absolutely.
Of the year and all that. Yeah. So I think I would probably just crush myself into oblivion trying to play as many events as possible. I don't know, though. It depends, I guess.
All right, well, former Andy Up Cruiser and Bracelet winner Stephen Lube finished fifth in event number 6, which is the 1500 shootout. And our longtime listeners probably remember when we invited Stephen on the show after he won at Bracelet in
Big O or something.
Big O, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Or no, it was PLO,
no,
but I
PLO,
think
but he loves Big O.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
It was Big O that he gave the credit for doing well in that. But this was a hold'em one, so he keeps going out there and doing well. And great guy, too. Always love when you have him on the cruise and the little group he brings. They're fun people. So I'm glad to see he's still having terrific success. And this one, I felt bad. Terminator Pizza Boy was texting me this, like, dude, Ted Forson heads up with Phil Hellmuth for the Raz title. How awesome is that? Turn it on! and I couldn't. But that was an event 7, $1,500 buy-in. What an amazing heads up! And that's the other part thing about the World Series is obviously we love to see amateurs like us, you know, make these great runs and get on the map. But if we're honest, we love to see these the big time pros tangle with each other, right?
Yeah.
And so it ended up Forrest ended up winning this. It was the sixth bracelet, his second in Raz. But a lot of this was interesting because the helmet, it was on the 25th anniversary of his main event title win. Boy, can you imagine? It's been 25 years since he won that.
Yeah.
And he now has 50 final tables and 101 caches in the World Series. And the stat I was looking for, Nolan Dahl, to put in that story, and I didn't see it, was how many heads up or runners up he had. Because he had that stretch, you know, what was that, 2 years ago or like that, where he kept missing, kept getting second.
Yep.
And this is yet another second. And seemed to handle it very well. Okay, he put out a nice little tweet congratulating Ted and saying, you know, if he couldn't win, he was glad it was Ted. So I don't know if he turned over any tables after he lost it or anything like that, but he seems to have been at least mature on Twitter about it.
You know,
but that's going to be tough to keep finishing second.
As far as tournament poker, I mean, there's just no doubt, right? He's the greatest player to ever play the game. I mean, really, tournament poker, I can't imagine anybody saying that Phil Hellmuth is not the best player when it comes to... Okay, so he's got more bracelets than anybody. He's proven that he can win bracelets other than Nolan Hold'em. And he can go deep in every event that's not... You know, it doesn't have to just be Nolan Hold'em. Now, cash games, he's not obviously not very good. He's not the greatest payer all
around.
Yeah,
it's tough to track that, too, because a lot of that's private and anecdotal and stuff like that. But I think he's admitted himself that, you know, cash is... He's not as strong as
I mean, you can see it for yourself when you watch on TV that he's just not that good. But, I mean, tournament poker. I mean, can you think of somebody better than him? I mean, in the prime, maybe, because, you know, the guys, Doyle and all those guys didn't play. They played the cash games because it was more important to them back then. But, really, I mean, this guy's phenomenal.
Yeah, I think the knock a couple years ago on him was that all he could do is play No Limit Hold'em.
Right.
I think he's clearly shown that he's got skills elsewhere right now, and you know, I'm happy for him. I mean, he's not, for whatever reason, he's not one of my favorite players. I guess just because the antics kind of turned me off.
Yeah.
But I certainly have mad respect for him, and I don't like when I'd said this on the show before too. I don't like when people like us that have no accomplishments whatever are making pot shots at these guys that have accomplishments for the accomplishments that they don't have.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's what always bothered me about people criticizing Hellmuth, because I'm like, come on, you know, whoever you are criticizing him, I trust, I guarantee you, you're not as good a player as he is. So you know, park into the garage a little bit, all right? So, but the fact that he's turning around and showing them that, you know, people can't make those pot shots out of anymore, I like that.
You know, and not only that, I mean, he comes here locally and plays in the charity event, does a great job with it, and then freaking final tables that. You know what I mean? Most of the pros, when they come here, they never go deep in those things. They just, you know, they're here to support the cause and sign things and have conversations and get out. But he shows that he could be any level of player. You could be fantastic, you could be beginner, and he's still going to beat you, or at least go deep in your event. Just a phenomenal player. And for whatever his antics are, you know, and whatever his persona is, that's, you know, whatever. But you can't deny how great he is as a poker player now. You just can't.
No way.
There's just no way.
And then the last big update through the first 11 events that I saw, Jonathan Dimmig, an amateur player that moved to Vegas to kind of explore being a pro player, realized that wasn't for him, and still plays a couple tournaments a year. He is the one that won the quote-unquote Millionaire Maker this year, which is event 8, $1,500 buy-in that guaranteed $1 million for the top prize. He ended up taking a little bit more than $1.3 million for the top prize, so they just pack the halls as they do with all these events.
That is phenomenal. Think about it. I mean, you paid $1,500 and you won $1.3 million. That is just remarkable.
I mean, even take the taxes out and everything. I mean, what of all the kind of stuff and the tip and, you know, taking your buddies out for $8 Ellis Island steaks afterwards. Even then, for a $1,500 buy.
Yeah, it's still like $900,000.
Staggering, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just so remarkable that, you know, they can do this with this game, and you just never know. If you work hard enough, you know, you can go far enough and get that good run. And, I mean, you know, Lee Childs is a good example of that, too. You know, he started out playing small, listening to us, that kind of thing, and then studied hard, worked hard, and then made the final table of the main event, and essentially was a millionaire after that. It's just crazy.
Absolutely.
It's an amazing game.
I mean, think about it. I mean, let's just assume, I don't know what tax they are. Let's say they're 45%, which is probably way high, but tip and everything like that. I mean, you're still talking, at worst, $650,000? Let's say you just take 50% off. $650,000? For players like you and me, that sets us up to play poker for the rest of our lives.
Oh, absolutely.
I can never exhaust that amount of money. If that became just my bankroll, which obviously wouldn't, I would do other things with it, but if that just became my bankroll, that would last me, if I lived 125, which at this point there's no chance I'm going to live past 65.
That would really, our home game, you would pretty much, everybody in our home game would be able to play any tournament we wanted to for the rest of our lives with that money.
That's probably true. That's a good way of looking at it. Yeah.
I mean, I know that the big, if you go officially on tour and you play all the main events, right, and all the big things, you're not going to do that. But I mean, for us, Jonathan Dimmick, obviously, he said he was going to try it, but he didn't do it. So he was actually probably working a job and just playing a couple events. So this would, if he does that for the rest of his life, this will clearly take care of that and take care of him. One event just changed his life. I mean,
yeah, probably a little tougher being in Vegas doing that, because I think there's probably more temptation to play more than, I mean, where we are here, I mean, I mean, the biggest event that we have coming up is our Andy Up Tour event at Derby Lane. Don't miss that at the end of August, by the way. Other than that, we essentially have to travel. So, I mean, I think we'd be a little bit more restrained with that. But if I was in Vegas, obviously, that would be tough. Because then
crazy.
Stumble out of my house or hotel and I make 4,000 events a year. But still, quite an accomplishment. And we'll check in next week with whatever concludes by then. But an amazing World Series already, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, well, you mentioned our good friend Lee Childs at the top of the show, and he's been kind of quiet about this. He's kind of given me a couple details as this was going on, but I really didn't know the whole story. But folks that follow him on Twitter probably know about this now. He tweeted last month that his courtroom victory over a former backer was a victory for all poker players. And essentially what happened is he was one of these players that once he started doing well, a backer approached him, and actually it was introduced to a mutual friend, and they entered into an agreement to back him, and I think they had about 2 years of experience or something like that through this whole thing. It ended very, very poorly, and ended up in court, and ended up winning. And his lawyer, and we'll put the link on this because I think it's a really fascinating read for poker players. It's going to take you a while because it's written by a lawyer, of course.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of links to supporting documents, including one that explains makeup and all kinds of stuff that I think a lot of probably our listeners are probably a little confused about. But you'll put the link in the
recap
in the forum, so go check that. But for some reason, you can't make it to the forum. His name is David Zeitlin, Zeitlin. So it's davidzeitlin.com. And I'm sure you can find it. But he posted essentially a blow-by-blow from all the way back to when Lee contacted him about this lawsuit all the way through the jury verdict. Fascinating stuff. And ultimately, the jury ruled that Lee violated all six tenets of the contract, which sounds pretty damning, right? But once you read the whole thing, you'll realize that some of these things he was set up to fail at. It was just a poorly written contract. But the jury decided that there's no material harm done to his backer from any of them, so therefore she wasn't entitled to any damages or compensation. She was seeking $40,000 back in failed makeup. And the lawyer eventually, Lee's lawyer, Lee contended it was more like $15,000. So she ended up getting nothing but a pretty big hefty legal bill, which Lee did as well.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what the lawyer said at the end of this. There really was no winner here. You can say that Lee lost because he violated the contract, even though he didn't have to pay anything for it, but obviously he had to pay a big legal bill. She obviously lost out on the money she thought she was getting as a big legal bill. And he said it's very, very rare, in fact almost incredibly rare, for something like this, you know, a lawsuit really essentially came down to $15,000 to get all the way to a jury trial. He really thought from the beginning that this was going to be one of those quick settle out of court kind of things, and it just wasn't.
I finally gotten around to reading it, and it is pretty remarkable that for this kind of money, you know, the legal fees are going to top that, and somewhere And somewhere in there, Lee was like, I'd rather pay you the money than her.
Yeah.
And that's true because he you know, I mean, it's not, I guess not on the level of, you know, the when the player, the baseball player has won the right to be traded, you know, to be free agents, things like that. But it's something along those lines where he felt that, you know, and then the other thing too is it calls light to anybody who wants to get into a deal for backing. You better enlist a lawyer.
Exactly.
To look at these contracts because, you know, clearly it was not in his favor. He was sort of young and naive when it came to stuff like that and was just happy to have a backer and a deal and thought it was a friendly handshake kind of thing. And, yeah, there was some stuff put down on paper, but it did not benefit him at all. And it was sort of ridiculous the way it was written. And so, you know, if you're ever going to get into a deal with somebody like that, unless it's your buddy and you're just saying, hey, I'll give you $50 to play in this tournament, pay me back if you win. You know, if it's something much with makeup and all that stuff, you better have a lawyer, somebody who's smart looking at it.
Yeah, so I think his tweet that it was a victory for all poker players is that now we have established case law on backing. And that was one of the things the lawyer got into. It like, you know, half our effort in this whole thing is explaining what makeup is and what backing is and the fact that Lee was playing online when people think it's illegal. And one nitpick I had, the lawyer was calling it illegal, and I still don't contend that online poker has ever been illegal. But but yeah, you have all that going on, and then, you know, and having to convince people of that and bring in expert witnesses, and there just wasn't any case law. So now there is case law. So I think there is probably protection for players here. I think the flip side is obviously backers are going to be a little more cautious, right? You know, you just had a backer that lost one. Even if the backers don't really side with her and how she ran her backing business, I think they're going to be a little more cautious. Obviously, people are going to have more lawyers involved, which on one hand you should. That was kind of the problem here. They had a bad contract, right?
Yeah.
They had good lawyers in the beginning. They would have had a better contract when they had this problem. But obviously that is an expense. And so I don't know. It would be interesting to see where this ends up going. But I guess at the end of the day, from the outside point of view, the fact that we have case law now on this is pretty striking.
Yep. Fantastic for him. Very happy for him. And if I'm being honest, I didn't know any of that was going on.
Well, he did a good job of, I believe. I mean, I don't really follow him on Twitter. I follow him on Facebook more, and he's more of a Twitter guy. But I think he did a good job of just not trying this case in public opinion.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, he talked to me a little bit about it on the cruise, last cruise he was on, and obviously some friends. I mean, his one of his business associates testified for him. His wife testified at the trial for him. So, I mean, obviously people in his inner circle really knew what was going on. But I think it speaks more to his character that he, from what I can tell, didn't make a big public to-do about this until now when it's done.
Yeah. Well, good for him, though. I'm really happy for him and Jenny and everybody else. I'm sure it was very trying for them. Even if it wasn't a lot of money, the stress of it and then the money they ended up ultimately paying must have really weighed down, and I'm glad they're finally through with it.
Sure. All right, so for reasons out of Antiup's control, Royal Caribbean has moved our December sailing to December 15th. Essentially what they did is they just chartered the ship. We were supposed to sail all earlier in the month, and they just chartered the ship out from under us.
Yeah.
Which I guess almost never happens, is what we heard, but it happened to us. So for any of you out there that were planning on going the December cruise, and hopefully hey, I couldn't go on December 6th, Scott. Well, guess what? Now you can go on December 15th. Royal Caribbean, to the degree that I think they couldn't be, are being really good to us and our players. So the cruise is going to be December 15th. Same itinerary. We're still going to the Cayman and Cozumel. Still 5 nights. Leaves on a Monday now instead of a Saturday. They're going to hold the line on the pricing, and they're also going to give every person, not stateroom, but every person, a $75 onboard credit. That's going to be on your account there, so that pretty much wipes out your gratuities, and still lets you buy a couple drinks, however you want to look at it. So that's a phenomenal deal now. So that actually, if you factor that in, gets the price well under $400 per person. So hopefully that's a good thing for all of our listeners that want to come and sail with us. So if you want to, please give us a call and book. And remember, we've got two other cruises coming up this year, July 28th out of Port Canaveral. We no longer have cabins in our control, but we are still buying them back. And at last check, insides at least, we're still at our advertised price. So call soon to get on that if you'd like. And then October 19th out of Galveston, Texas. And hopefully within the next couple weeks, we will announce our 2015 schedule. We already have Infernal informal confirmation from Royal Caribbean on that, so we're just waiting for the actual contracts before we make it public. But give you a little preview for the NEF PokerCast listenership. We'll be doing our normal Port Canaveral and Tampa sailings next year. But also, we're going to return to Baltimore for an 8-nighter. And I had so much fun on this last 13-night cruise. We're going to do another one. We're not going to cross the pond this time, but we're going to sail from Boston to Tampa this year. So a little bit of something for everybody. And remember to go to anteupcruises.com for details on all the cruises we have announced right now. And check back there in a couple weeks, and we'll have all these new cruises posted there as well, too. And then you can give Chris's lovely wife, Jeannie, a call, and she will get you booked.
All right. Each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 206-338-6344 or emailed us at podcast@anteupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call of the Floor and Hand of the Week, we'll send them something fantastic. This week's sponsor is TournamentButton.com, which offers a variety of home dealer buttons and, with timers built right into them. You can even customize them with your own photo or logo. Ask about the Anteup logo version and use code Anteup for free shipping. This comes from Jerry. So is there any way that I could have gotten away from these hands, all of which I went broke with? I had ace-jack, ace-queen, and ace-king, and raised pre, and got calls from a tight player, and each time I hit top pair with the ace-kicker, and they had a set. Each time I was in middle position, and the player had position on me. Not sure if it is just bad luck, or that they have a, set, or should I know once a tight player calls a preflop raise and flop bet, alarm should go off, and I should just shut it down. When I raise and get called, then bet the flop and get called by a tight player, should I just shut down on the turn? Each time the game was 1-2, no limit hold'em, and I had $300, and the other players had between $170 and $300. Each of the hands had a straddle, so my pre-raise was higher than usual.
And what I wrote back to him was, I'm not so much concerned about how we played these pre-flop. My concern is, how did you end up going broke?
Yeah, with just one pair.
You know, obviously there's some details missing here, that at some point in this hand, this thing escalated to a point that it shouldn't have for top pair, top kicker.
Yeah.
And that's really the problem here. I mean, obviously none of these hands are bad hands to start with. You know, I have been weeding myself off of anything below ace king in the ace family lately. But you know, obviously it sounds like he raised significantly pre-flop, so he did that well, and you know, made a nice bet on the flop. Obviously, you know, the sets are unlucky, but what's that's out of your control, obviously, whatever your opponent has and what they do. But what's in your control is putting the chips in the pot, right?
Yeah.
And at some point, I mean, I don't know what this is. It's 1-2, it's a straddle, so maybe he's raising 10, 15, 20 bucks pre-flop. Let's say 20 just to be, you know, crazy. And then betting 30, 40 on the flop. How do you get from that 60 or 70 to 300? That's the problem, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, because the other thing, too, is, yeah, okay, you're in middle position, so you loosen up your starting hands a little bit, but I just absolutely hate ace-jack. I frown on ace-queen. You know what I mean? So ace-king is really a, I mean, yeah, maybe ace-queen, and that's fine, but ace-jack is really, and if you're hitting your jack, and you got a call from somebody behind you who's tight, and, you know, they call your raise, and all you have is jacks, you know what I mean? And they're betting, they're calling you, and they're betting, and there's no draw out there. They've got to have something. You certainly shouldn't be going broke with a pair of jacks and an ace kicker. You should not be going broke no matter what the situation is. So that's probably more about how you're playing post-flop than it is how you played pre-flop. So I'm not really condemning the ace-jack plays, but, you know, you should really think about not even playing that hand unless you're maybe one off the button or on the button or, you know, cut off, whatever. So, but anyway, yeah, to go broke in 1-2 with ace-jack and flopping a pair of jacks, you know, and I wouldn't shut it down because otherwise this guy's just going to float you the rest of the day, and every time you raise and they call your bet and you check the flop or you check the turn, they're gonna float to the turn and then take it away from you. So you can't play that way. You can't play scared that way, but you have to understand, you know, that you don't have an unbelievably powerful hand. If somebody gets it all in with you at that point, then you need to say, hey, I only have jacks. You know, I'm going to go broke with it. You know, that's another tournament rule, is that, you know, you never go broke with less than two pair.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're, I wouldn't, in a tournament, at least I only had to pay one thing. In a cash game, I could, you know, $300, so I'm not going to want to lose $300 on a pair of jacks. So
No. Think
about your post-flop play more than what you're doing wrong. The first thing he said was, is there any way I can get away from these hands? Yes. Yes. Just you know, feel out what he's doing, and then maybe check behind. I mean, check the turn, or make a smallish bet on the turn. If he calls again down the river, you have to check it because you're obviously behind it. There's no draw, that kind of thing. So I would just not put as much weight into one pair, one kicker, you know, as you did apparently. So that's the best way to get away from it, I think.
Yeah, and this, speaking of Lee Childs, this is the absolute best advice he's ever given me of all the great advice he's given me, is that turn check to control the pot. You know, and obviously every situation's different, but let's just say a normal template with the hands that Jerry's playing, you raise pre-flop, you make your C-bet, you get called, maybe now you check the turn just for pot control and to be cautious, and if the guy checks behind, great. And then you make another stab on the river. If he bets on the turn, then that's your chance to evaluate it at that point. But I'm going to guess what happened instead was he fired that next bullet. At that point, you know, you're getting pretty close to being all in at that point. And whatever he had left got in on the river. So, and then checking the turn, I think, is amazing for pot control.
Yeah, you just can't do it all the time because you'll get pot stolen from you, too. So.
Sure.
Yeah, but absolutely, checking the bet, checking the turn to control the pot, and then if he does bet, decide, all right, is this a real bet, or is he stealing from me, what kind of player is he, what's he been up to this point, that kind of thing, and then you can get away, that's how you get away from it, you know, but you don't always do it, because then they're just going to keep stealing from you, so you got to really understand the player you're going against.
All right, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and not sure what the proper ruling should have been. Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll have Antiup Poker Tour Tournament Director Sam Minatello tell you how he would have ruled. This comes from our good friend and valet, Dave Palm, and he says, we were playing in a 2-5 no-limit hold'em cash game in a Los Angeles area card room. The board reads X, deuce, deuce, XX. Seat 6 bets $35. Seat 9 says raise and puts out $105. Seat 3 calls for less. Seat 6 shoves for about $350. At this point, seat 2, who was dealt in the hand but no longer had cards, calls string raise on seat 9. The discussion broke out among players about whether it was or wasn't a string raise and whether it was too late to call it if it was. During the discussion, seat 9 calls, turns over the winning ace-deuce, and scoops in the pot, rendering the discussion moot. But a few of us continue to discuss it, wondering what the floor would have ruled.
Okay, Sam says, generally it is up to the dealer to notify a player if a raise is not legal or a string raise. I have played in a few poker rooms where it is the player's responsibility to call for the string raise. That being said, I would also say that string raise has to immediately be called on a player. And in this situation, there are two actions before another player decides to speak up. So I would say the $105 re-raise would stand, and action would continue on as it did. I agree.
I got no problem with this.
All right.
Quick on the draw there.
That's
know?
Right. Speak up.
Hey, wait a minute. Remember that hand 7 hands ago? That was a string raise.
They should call it the marriage rule. Speak now or forever hold your peace. All right. We get to complete O'Malley's move. Let's remind ourselves with part one.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're playing 2-5 No Limit Hold'em, and the table we're at is a good one. Slightly timid, easy to push around, and we've become the table captain. We're up 200 as we sit with 7. The blinds post, and we're under the gun with 2 red 9s. The table standard raise is 4x, and we're going to make it. If we get callers, we can represent strength on the flop if any overs come. Since we're raising from under the gun, we might get credit for a bigger hand than nines. We get 2 callers, an MP and the big blind, and we go to the flop with $60 in the pot, which is the 4 of hearts, 3 of spades, 3 of hearts. This is a pretty decent flop, and after the big blind checks, we make a $40 stab at it. Both players call. The MP started the hand with around 450. He's a pretty solid player, but he has a weak spot in that he likes to chase draws too much. I think it's pretty conceivable here to put him on a heart draw. I think he'd fold a big ace after our bet on the flop. He could also have something like 8s or 7s. The big blind is a bit of a calling station. He really could have anything here, including a meager 2 overs. He started the hand with 600. At this point, I think we're ahead of their range. The turn is the 5 of diamonds, and once again the big blind checks. There's 180 in the pot, and we're going to keep up the aggression. but we want to price out the draws. We make a bet of 150 just to show we're serious about this hand. Once again, both players call. The river is the 8 of clubs, completing virtually no draws, and once again, the big blind checks. So are we happy with the size of the pot, or are we value betting?
I find it hard to imagine two players are calling off an almost pot-sized bet of 150 bucks on the turn with draws. So I'm going to have to put at least one of them on a 4 or a 5. I think ace 5 makes sense for someone based on how the hand had developed. Or a medium pair. We have 6s and 7s crush, but not 10s or jacks. So 50-50, I think I'm inclined to check with the intention of calling any bet.
Yeah, you know, I'm like you. I'm pretty confident that we're ahead, but I'm not so confident. So I'm going to bet out here and into a $600 pot because it's going to have to be a significant bet. And then if I only get raised, now it's making me guess needlessly.
Sure,
so
yeah.
I'm willing to check and call anything reasonable considering the size of the pot in the hand that I have. So,
boo, and we agree.
I know, I hate it. All right, here we go. Here's see what happens.
Hello again. I'm pretty happy with this pot. There's over $600 in it, and even though I'm pretty sure we're ahead, a proper bet would be a shove, and even though we cover both of these opponents, there's just no sense in that. We're only going to get called by a better hand. We check. The MP thinks for quite a while. It's almost as if he's contemplating a shove. After what seems like an eternity, he checks. Phew, I was willing to call a shove there. The big blind confidently tables deuces. We show our nines, and the MP mucks. Nice pot. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying it's okay to mix it up with medium pairs from time to time. If you miss flopping your set, you could represent strength post-flop if you represented it pre-flop. But be careful, you could get snapped off. I hope to see you on the felt.
I think it's pretty hard for us to imagine getting paid off there, so I certainly don't. I don't think there's any harm in not value betting, which I guess is what we'd be doing there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not truly a value betting. But I gotta say, I'm ecstatic that I'm in a game with a player who will call off that much on the turn with an open ender.
Yeah,
we
you know,
put that was a good sized bet there, and for that kind of hand to be calling that, I guess that's why they're called calling stations, right?
Yep. The minute he said that he tabled deuces and a middle position player mucked, I was like, whew. You know, I consider this well played. I think we maximized because we made the proper huge turn bet.
Absolutely.
And we would never get called in that situation ever again by two people, you know, for that amount of money. So, you know, not making a questionable bet on the end is perfectly fine with me. We probably maximized. We got a ton of money out of this hand. And I think I'm happy with it. So I'm glad and just relieved that we weren't behind and got to take it down.
Yeah, I think this is a hand that kind of illustrates what I've told people before, why I'm not a big poker book guy. And I have no problem with poker authors. I think it's the medium that makes it difficult. Is that, I mean, obviously we had some more information from players here, but if you just took a static computer evaluation of how to play these hands, this wouldn't be how it would come out, right? But now you know that these players are willing to call these big bets on the turn with really crap. And now you have to adjust to that going throughout the rest of the game, where normally I wouldn't be making those big turn bets. But now that I know that they've shown me that they're going to call them, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And that's where I'm going to make my money, because obviously, you know, the guy wasn't going to call on the river with the deuces. You know, he was just stringing along, hopefully that's straight.
Yep. Or so another deuce, maybe. But yeah. Yep.
Which is the exact opposite of what I just said in the last one, where you had to check that turn for pocket control.
This is Justin Bonomo, and you're listening to Antia.
All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And this comes from a new friend, Jay Grimes.
Must I just react to that? I don't know.
No, I just...
okay, I didn't know.
Yeah, I kind of wish that I had a Jay name, because then I would just shorten it to Jay, because I think that's just kind of cool. Jay. And because it goes well with anything, because Jay just comes off the tongue a little bit. I can't go, hey, it's S. Long.
No, Jay.
Because then it's almost like Slong. And then I went through elementary school with that going on, right?
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
all right, so he says he's had a full ring game at a local casino. We're playing 1-3 no limit hold'em with a $100 to $300 buy-in range. I've been playing for quite a few hours and have yo-yoed from down 70 to up 200 multiple times.
Jeez.
So Jay Grimes is an action player. I start the hand in the big blind with 375 behind. And he says, I think my image is somewhat taggish, tight aggressive. I've made a couple bluffs and didn't have to show any of those hands, and shown down hands with good value over the night. Says, villain number one is new to the table, having shown up about 90 minutes ago. He's done a good job of creating the image of a loose, aggressive, borderline maniac. He's been involved in most of the hands, raised pre-flop multiple times, and followed up with several c-bets. In addition, he's being loud and abrasive, talks constantly, and has made the statement that he's here to gamble on quite a few occasions.
Okay.
It might be an act, but if so, he's got his act down pretty good. He's up to starting stack to something close to what I have. Villain number two is the polar opposite. Seems to be in his 50s, and although I know he's been at the table for 4-plus hours, I couldn't tell you anything about him. He's doubled his starting stack to around 600, but I don't recall any huge pots he's won, so I'm going with a standard tag player, slow and steady.
Okay.
Villain number one is in the cutoff and straddles for six. Villain number two is on the button and calls. I'm going to assume there's folds in between that. Small blind folds, and we're in the big blind with jack of diamonds, jack of spades.
Fold. You can't win with them. You can't fold them. And what's the other thing?
All I know is either all in or fold. It's the only way I play jacks. Which I don't always do that, but if I don't go all in or fold, terrible things happen.
Right, so they can't win is the other thing. They can't win, and you can't fold them. So I would say try to fold them very hard here, but I'm just joking. Jeez. So I mean, straddle, so that's the other thing, is I don't know what this aggressive guy's going to do on the straddle. You know, in the old days, if you knew they were going to raise every time they straddled, I would just call here. And then
I'm
going to
guess
raise.
Because he's borderline maniac, that he's still one of those old school straddlers. That,
okay.
He's probably going to raise without even looking at his
card. Then I'm just going to call. I'm going to call and let him do that, and then I'm going to come over the top. And I know my jacks are probably better than what he has. Although, maybe the last time I did this, I got screwed. But I'm not going to just be the one who remembers only the bad things. Most of the time, this play... this works a lot. And so I'm just going to call here, even though the last time I think I went up kings against aces. And I think I sucked out on them. But I didn't. It was a time before I sucked out on the guy. This time, I just got beat. So, I'm going to just call and see if this guy does his, you know, hey, I'm a maniac, I'm here to play, and now I'm going to make it 30 to go.
Yeah, and this is why I usually get it from the table when a maniac sits down, because for me, they're just so hard to play against, because this is kind of the mindset they push you in, right? You're waiting for a good hand, and then I'm like, all right, I'm going to make him make a bet, and then bazinga! And then he's going to bazinga me back with waking up with aces or kings and ruin my night. And really, I don't know. There's two schools of thought here. There's one, which is what you're saying, which is exactly what I would do, is check, let him do his dog and pony show raise, right? And then re-raise him over the flop, pre-flop, to show him, hey, I got my bazinga now. In which case, he probably doesn't care. He's going to re-raise us, and then we're going to play for stacks pre-flop, which I never like to do, although I think jacks are probably good there. Or do you just call the bazinga raise and try to milk him for a little bit more, knowing that your jacks are going to be pretty vulnerable? Because I promise you, it's just a law of poker. A queen, king, or ace is going to come out in that flop.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm definitely for the let's hope he raises, and then we make it such a big raise that he can't do anything, because I don't want to see a flop. I just want to take his money down now.
Yeah, because here's the problem. This is what this guy forces you into, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing to be forced into, but he's forced us into a situation now where we're happy to play for stacks with jacks pre-flop, right?
Right.
Which, against any other player, you would not be ecstatic about that, right?
Right.
But at this point, you just know that there's going to be the action's going to be heavy here, so you just got to make that. I think you got to make that decision in your brain that this is just one of those hands that I'm going to gamble with this guy with, because I'm pretty sure most times I'm going to have the best of them and hope it holds up, which is the exact reason I get it from the table. Because that's just not the way I want to play poker, right?
So I know how to make you leave your own house then.
Absolutely.
All right, cool.
Yep.
Next time we have a home game,
I'll be self-deal the rest of the time after.
Self-dealing.
All right, so our hero says, I guess he had a limp because he had to call the straddle, right? So he just called. He says, I did so because I was going to re-raise when villain one raises his straddle. I've seen him do this often. And villain one does raise to 26, but villain two also calls.
Oh, man, that's awesome. That's more dead money in the pot. Now, see, this is why you like this.
You're not worried about what Villain 2 has here?
No, I'm not.
This guy that's been here for 4 hours and we don't even know he's at the table?
No, because if he had a hand, why wouldn't he not now re-raise?
Okay, well, this is going back to what I said, the two schools of thought. You can either re-raise pre-flop with these jacks, or you could just call his crazy raise and then lie in the weeds and hope to spring later. So I'm not saying that's what Villain 2 is doing, but he might choose a different path right now.
But
so
he also,
obviously, when we raise, then we'll find out.
He also has us behind him, and if we're thinking the same way he's thinking, then he would re-raise now to get us out.
Yeah.
Not to call again and hope that I'm going to just call and then hit my cards. This guy didn't re-raise, and I'm going to think that I'm still ahead, and I'm going to make a huge bet here.
You're probably not wrong, but I'm going to say this other guy probably also said, hey, this guy's in the big blind. He calls for $4. You know, yeah. I don't know.
You could be right. You could be right.
We'll see.
I'm going to make a big bet, though.
All right.
I'm going to bet like 125 here.
All right. Our hero says, to me, villain number one's raise was inconsequential, but villain's two call caught me up my attention. I could still re-raise, but if I'm called, then I'll be out of position with jacks. So I just call, hoping to see a flop and reassess my options at the point. The middle position player also calls, which I guess is villain number one. So we go four-handed the flop with 110 the pot. So I guess there was a
mystery another guy. Player in there.
There's a mystery guy in this pot that we didn't know.
Then I'm gonna make it even more. I'm probably gonna shove.
Yeah, at that point, I don't want to go up against four people.
Yeah.
Because now you've turned, which is fine, you've turned this into a set mining hand. But it's not fine that you're putting $26 in the set mine. That's just
no. With two other players that clearly knew that. I mean, this villain two knew that there was another guy behind him and another and us behind him. And when he got that pop from the straddler, and he would not want to be in the hand with us if he had something like ace king, you know what I mean? So if he had a hand that was vulnerable, like tens or something. So clearly this guy, I don't think we're behind this guy. I think we got the biggest hand now, and I think we need to do something about it. So I would not call here.
Yeah, it's now we got to hit a set here, or I'm not going to be happy. Because this is going to be a problem if the board comes all under jacks. Because we're going to have that false sense of security, and I just don't think four-handed that's what we want.
Yeah.
All right, well, no problem in that assessment because the flop is Jack of Hearts, Queen of Clubs, Six of Diamonds. So we have hit our set. Not top set, obviously, but it's not Omaha, so we're not worried, right?
Yeah. Well, it's hand of the week, so we're worried, but we're not worried when we're actually in the moment. I don't think.
And we are first to act.
Well, you know what, though? Cards that would be calling these raises or making these raises, though, would be roughly Broadway. I am kind of worried that somebody flopped a set of queens, but I feel like the queens, unless it was the actual straddler who had them, it'd be odd to see that they would just call with those queens. So I think we're ahead.
Exactly.
But the Broadway stuff scares me. So we've got, what,
110 the pot.
110 the pot. So, you know, I have no problem betting 100 here.
Yeah, I'm putting a stack of society out there.
Yeah, stack of society makes sense.
All right, so our hero says, that's a pretty good flop, but I check, because I'm going for a check raise on villain number one. Middle position also checks, and villain number one now bets $75. So I guess the straddle was out. The straddle was in the cutoff, that's right.
Yeah, cutoff.
All right, so villain number one bets $75, and villain number two screws up all my grand plans by going all in.
And he's got us covered big time. Huh. Yeah, I can't fold a set here. Can you?
Oh, boy. I would like to say that I can't, but just the fact that this guy is this quiet, moving up kind of guy, he's got to 600 now. I mean, it's one of these things where I'm going to, like, I call, please don't show me queens, and he's going to show me queens 9 out of 10 times, isn't it, right? Which is not a reason to fold because... You know, you still got that chance, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. I'm trying to think what else. Maybe Queen Jack? If it was a case Jack, that makes it a little unlikely, but I can't imagine this guy doing anything, maybe a set of sixes.
Yeah.
But is this guy that's, you know, slow and steady wins the race going to call $27 preflop with a pair of sixes? I don't think so.
But the question is, with two people behind him to act who have called the straddle, If he has pocket queens and the straddler finally wakes up and bets his 26 preflop, does he really just call 20 with two more people behind him?
You're making very good points. So that's a good point as to why he can have queens, but I can't come up with a good point for him having anything else that makes sense.
Yeah, unless maybe...
So that's kind of the problem, sixes. You know what I mean?
Maybe sixes, but yeah, it's a bad set mining play, but maybe sixes, I don't know. Maybe he thought people would fold behind him after the raise.
And I could see a suited queen jack. I mean, that might be a hand that I would put 27 in, just because with all those people in. And we have that beat. But again, we have, you know, three of the jacks are already counted for.
Yeah.
And we're not going to miscount the jacks. It's not like we miscounted the queens last week, so...
And there's no flush draw. So,
no.
You know what I mean? So it's really, would he do this with a straight draw with 600 when he's been quiet and he's in his 50s and kind of reserved? Probably not. He's not doing it on a draw. So it feels like could be queen jack or a set of sixes. I mean, if it's a set of queens, then this guy, I don't know how he got a stack the way he did. I mean, I guess it could be tricky, but that doesn't seem tricky to me. It seems careless.
Well, I think the other argument here, obviously this guy is made up to 600, he knows what he's doing, or he got lucky, and it doesn't sound, if he got lucky, I think somebody would notice him, right? Like, oh my gosh, he sucked out on something. Obviously he hasn't done that, right?
Yeah.
So the other line of thinking is that somebody has to take control of this hand with this crazy guy, right?
Yeah.
And maybe he's just decided it's going to be me. You know, there's 110 in the pot, and now there's, you know, 75 more. I'm going to be the sheriff that takes this guy down now and get heads up with him, and maybe this, you know, he's going to scare him and try to drive the two of us out with something like, you know, ace-queen or something, I guess. Because that's really what we're trying to do, right, is take control of this thing. You know, obviously we're in a much better spot with our set of jacks than I thought we'd be at this point.
Yeah. But,
so that's the other scenario that I can imagine. So I guess we have three different scenarios. Only one of them is bad. So you're right. I guess final analysis, I can't fold here.
No, I can't fold. I can't. I mean, given what the story told and the likelihood of the things, I have to call. So I'm calling.
All right. Our hero says, I go over my options, fold or go all in myself, since villain two's all in has me covered. I take a minute to figure out where I'm at. Middle set versus maniac ledge versus a tight player. Villain number two is the one I'm concerned about, and try to go through the various hands he could have that will allow me to make a preflop call 26 and an all-in move after the flop. I figure villain two can only have ace-ace, king-king, queen-queen, and possibly ace-king or ace-queen, but I think he only goes all-in with those last two if he thinks I check for weakness. I think the villain has a wide range and was just making a regular c-bet. I decide villain number two has one of the top three pairs, and only against queen-queen am I pretty much dead. I have 349 left behind, so it'll cost me 349 to call. The pot has 534 in it. I feel a bit queasy about the call, but if it's set first set, so be it.
Yeah, so be it.
You know, I had dismissed ace-ace and king-king. I don't know why. I mean, I guess we just figured...
For the same reasons why we dismissed queen-queen. Yeah. I mean, why would he not now pop it to get the two others out who could...
But again, it's that other way of looking at it that I think that some people do against these villains is just waiting for the flop to spring their trap. And, you know, that this was what they were hoping for, I guess. So, but... Yeah, at this point, I hope he has those hands because we have those crushed, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Just don't show me queens, please. he says, villain number one then also goes all in. So while my implied odds just jump from 349:534 to 349:883, I'm happy that I'm getting better odds, but starting to think I'm drawn into the case jack.
Oh, man. Let's hope that guy doesn't have queens, and it's not even villain two. We're worried about villain one now. That would be hilarious.
Yeah, so apparently this middle position player that comes in and out of this hand is gone now.
Okay.
Everyone is all in, and villain number two shows ace of diamonds, queen of hearts.
Yeah, I had a feeling that might have been the case too, so that's good.
I think, I guess it goes out of that final thing where we just felt that he was going to take control of the hand, but wow. Folks, this is why you don't play ace-queen.
And it helps with the other guy too, because it's less likely he has the case-queens.
Villain number one flips over king of diamonds, ten of hearts.
Open-ended. Oh, no!
The turn is the eight of diamonds, and I nearly had a heart attack because I thought villain number one caught the straight. Nope. For that fun experience, I had to wait until the river when the dealer rolled off the nine of spades.
Oh, man.
Not quite sure if there's a side pot. I flip over my set of jacks, and when the money is counted, nope, Bill and one had me covered. Oof.
Ooh, brutal. I can imagine somebody having a straight draw there, but do you really want to get it in? I guess you do once in a while and stuff like that, but that's...
Yeah, that kind of player, absolutely. Yeah. He's looking for those kind of things. Yeah. You know, most of the times he's raising with air. So, I mean, yeah. He technically had air there, but he had really good air. He had, like, the Perrier of air.
But let's...
And a review. Lot of money in the pot.
Let's review, though, okay? Not sure. Results-oriented, but let's review if Jay Grimes had played it our way, or my way. I don't know what you were going to do. I forget. So, pre-flop, we called and let him make his raise. We had the ace-queen in there, which, you know, gladly, we would gladly go against that with Jack-Jack in this situation. So, if we had made it the 125-150 because we had that extra middle position guy in there, the king 10 does not call. The ace queen maybe calls, but I think he gives us more respect than he does to the straddler, and he's probably out, and the middle position player is gone, and we take down a healthy $75 pot.
Yep.
Instead, we're out $375, and the straddler, who shouldn't even been in the hand, got you to play exactly the way he wanted you to play for him, and got the other guy to do the same thing, and got the middle position player to do the same thing. When this happens and you play it that way, you have to follow through. The whole point of you not raising before it got back to the straddler was so that you could trap him and do it. Just because the other guy came along, he has to know that there's still two behind him who could be playing it that way, so why would he just call? You know, if he had a big hand, he would raise to get us out. So he didn't have a big hand. He had ace-queen, very marginal, and we should have made it 120 or 150 to go pre- and taking it down there and been happy to move on to the next hand with 75 more in our coffers. Instead, we're broke. Yeah, so we can't do that. We got to really follow through on our plan and play the player the way it needs to be played. And I realized that there was that other guy in the hand, but really, if he had a hand at that moment, he would have sprung it because he had two of us behind it for a mere $26. We already put six in. So for 20, for four little, you know, red chips, we're in there with you and sucking out on your ace-queen. And making you lose, you know, 375 of your 500 for that one stupid play to not reprop it or whatever. So I think the play there with the Jack-Jack was definitely to make it 125, 150 to go.
I will not disagree.
Yeah, that King-10 is not there after that, and you're all set. Too bad, though. I feel bad, JJ. Sorry, buddy. But the good news is that we're going to put your call the floor item in the magazine this issue. So make sure you read our July issue, and you'll see your call the floor and have it addressed by our good friend Sam Minotello. All right, next week's our last show before the big five-show binge thing. So if you've got anything to say to us, say it now. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Locke.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.